Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
Chechnya's leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, is squarely behind Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine. Kadyrov even suggested using nukes on the battlefield.
But if things don't turn out well for Russia and for Putin, Kadyrov is likely to try to establish, you know, his own state.
A Putin ally smells opportunity. Also ahead, President Biden is relaxing penalties for marijuana possession. We look at how Washington stacks up with the rest of the globe.
You already have the UN recognizing the therapeutic value and changing the treatment of cannabis on the international treaty.
Plus, unpacking British Prime Minister Liz Truss's rocky start.
You've got the Bank of England stepping in now to try and clean up a mess a government has caused. That has never happened.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We begin our program today with news from Oslo. The 2022 Nobel Peace Prize was awarded today to two human rights groups and one human rights activist. The winners come from Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more about the winners.
Hello?
You know how you get a call from the Nobel Committee and you're, like, totally unprepared?
Yes, hello. Is this Mrs. Romantsova?
Yeah, Alexandra Romantsova, it's me.
I'm calling you on behalf of the Norwegian Nobel Committee to inform you that the Center for Civil Liberties will be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for 2022.
It's great. Thank you.
Alexandra Romantsova is the executive director of the Center for Civil Liberties in Ukraine. And this was a moment of elation in a difficult year. The center has been documenting Russian war crimes against civilians in Ukraine. They collect testimonies and sift through evidence. They've said they're finding it impossible to cope with the sheer number of testimonies coming in every day, with the scale and brutality of it all. You can hear this in Romantsova's voice.
It's incredible, seriously. So it's really cool.
The Russian human rights group Memorial also won the prize. They heard the news while they were waiting outside a Moscow courtroom. They were trying to stop the Russian authorities from seizing their office building. Memorial campaigns for democracy and civil rights in Russia and former Soviet republics. The group was banned last December as part of a crackdown on critics of the Kremlin. It was accused of violating a law requiring certain civil society groups to register as foreign agents. Memorial had been compiling a list of political prisoners in Putin's Russia when it was shut down. And then there's the third laureate, Belarusian human rights activist Aleš Białocki. Here's his friend and colleague Katya Glod.
He's probably the most prominent human rights defender in Belarus. He's done this work for 30 years, and he has actually been nominated for Nobel Peace Prize 5 times. So I think he really deserves this.
Aleš Białocki is behind bars. He was arrested more than a year ago and is being held without trial. This is not his first stint in jail. He was also imprisoned from 2011 to 2014 on a trumped-up tax evasion charge.
He's always been able to resist any pressure to stop this work, any pressure on his family, any danger to his own life. It's quite amazing.
Just before his latest arrest, Białocki wrote on Facebook that the Belarusian authorities under strongman Alexander Lukashenko are acting as a regime of occupation. He wrote, "There are hundreds of thousands of demonstrators across all of Belarus, and hundreds of them are detained." All the winners of the Nobel Prize this year have in some way stood up to Russian President Vladimir Putin or his ally Lukashenko. But Berit Riis-Andersen, the chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, said they weren't trying to send a message to Putin.
We give a prize to people who are champions of peace. We do not give a prize against anyone.
And yet,
Obviously, we are sending a signal that war must end.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
On the ground in Ukraine, the counteroffensive against Russian forces shows no signs of stopping. Ukraine's military continues to liberate towns and villages in the southern and eastern parts of the country. In a video address yesterday, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed some of Ukraine's recent gains.
Інформуємо про наш рух на передовій.
He said over the last week, Ukraine has liberated about 200 square miles of territory. He also said, quote, the day will come when we will also talk about the liberation of Crimea. The World's Daniel Offman has been following all this and joins me now. Daniel, what's the latest on Ukraine's military advances?
Well, last month we saw the beginning of a rapid counteroffensive conducted by Ukraine's military. Within a couple of weeks, Ukraine was able to reverse 5 months of Russian advances. Ukrainian troops liberated large swaths of territory in the northeast, in the Kharkiv region, but also made some progress in the south, in the Kherson region. Right now, though, Ukraine isn't advancing at the same speed that it was last month because they're now facing areas that have a higher concentration of Russian forces. But as we heard Zelensky announce yesterday, they're still forcing the Russian military to retreat in some areas.
Now, I know you were able to speak with a Ukrainian officer who's currently on the front lines in eastern Ukraine. What did he tell you?
That's right, Carol. I spoke with Colonel Oleksiy Nozdrachov. We spoke about some of the gains that Ukraine has made recently in the Kharkiv region. Here's what he said about Russia's retreat in some of those areas.
The Russian forces left hundreds of tanks, armored vehicles, and artillery pieces, hundreds of tons of ammunition. The counteroffensive so much shocked the Russian military that they were not able to evacuate all this equipment from these areas.
Colonel Nozdrachov said that Russian forces did try to destroy some of that equipment, but a lot of it remains in good shape.
It significantly helped Ukrainian logistic to reinforce and resupply Ukrainian units on the front line. So everything which is able to be used was immediately used against Russian forces.
That's amazing. Now, on a different matter, I know it's been a couple of weeks now since Russia's military said that it would mobilize another 300,000 troops to fight in Ukraine. Has that changed the situation on the ground in Ukraine?
Well, here's what we know. We've seen a lot of evidence that the mobilization effort on Russia's side has hit some roadblocks. We've seen evidence that many troops aren't adequately supplied. We've seen many cases where newly mobilized troops aren't getting proper training, are being transported near Ukraine without orders. Often there's no leadership on the ground, no officers, no direction. But despite all of that, the mobilization continues. Here's Sergei Grabsky. He's a retired Ukrainian colonel.
Despite of all difficulties with mobilization, despite of absence of a mobilization system in Russia, Russians in a certain period of time, in half a year, would be able to gather a required number of troops.
So the mobilization can take a long time, but there's also another question. What will Russia do with these newly mobilized forces? Some think that the new forces will be used to fill the gaps on the front lines. But also, there's another possibility that newly mobilized forces could be used to secure territory that Russia currently occupies, and that could buy Russia time and extend this war.
But in the meantime, now that Ukraine's military is on the offensive, what is Russia trying to accomplish right now?
Well, Carol, just last week, in a move condemned by countries across the globe, President Putin announced that Russia is annexing 4 regions within Ukraine. So Russia's top priority in the short term is securing these regions. As we noted, though, Ukraine's military has the momentum. Despite that, Russian troops are still trying to push west in the Donetsk region, and that's a risky move. Here's Sergei Grabsky again.
Mainly it's about the miscoordination and the political demands. It has nothing to do with the military purposes and the common sense of military operation, but it's about the political demands over there.
So we're seeing a situation where it looks like major military decisions are being made based on political aspirations. In other words, Russia is trying to control the entire Donetsk region. However, even if they're able to push Ukraine back, it could push Russian forces into a vulnerable situation which could play into Ukraine's hands.
The World's Daniel Offman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
Ramzan Kadyrov is the Kremlin-backed leader of Chechnya, a Muslim-majority Russian republic in the Caucasus Mountains. He's a controversial figure and a key supporter of Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. Now, according to reports, Putin has promoted Kadyrov to the status of a Russian military general. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
Ramzan Kadyrov is a recognizable figure, usually in military fatigues and a big boxy beard. He's a modern-day warlord who gets into Twitter fights with Elon Musk and sends rambling messages to his roughly 3 million followers on Telegram. This is from a video call with his fighters in Ukraine. The Kadyrovites, as they're known, have reportedly been fighting since the war began. Ramzan is the son of a famous Chechen separatist leader who fought against the Russians in the 1990s and 2000s.
Many Russian soldiers are young, inexperienced, and unhappy about having to fight the Chechens.
Russia fought two wars in Chechnya. The second ended in 2009. Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, was leveled. Tens of thousands of civilians were killed. Later, human rights groups discovered mass graves. In the aftermath, rose the Kadyrovs, father and son. But now they were pro-Kremlin. When the elder Kadyrov was assassinated in 2004, Ramzan took over with the blessing of Russia's leader.
President Vladimir Putin came to power in the year 2000 and became known to the Russian public for this war against Chechnya, to bring back Chechnya into the Russian Federation.
Valery Zutsati teaches at the University of Kansas.
And Kadyrov implemented Russian policies of subjugation, of repression, and all kinds of other policies in Chechnya.
So in a way, Zutsati says, Kadyrov is crucial to Putin's identity as the Russian leader who brought Chechnya back to the empire.
They depend on each other, Putin and Kadyrov.
Chechnya provides a model for Russia's goals in Ukraine, says Miriam Katerina Hess. She's with the German Council on Foreign Relations. And beyond that, she says, the Chechen warlord has global influence.
Kadyrov can be used to consolidate alliances with the Arab world by, for example, staging himself as a Muslim and demonstrating that, for example, in Russia, it is possible to conflate foreign policy and religion by, for example, calling fighting in the Ukraine, in the Ukraine war, a jihad.
Earlier this week, Kadyrov announced that his three sons will go to Ukraine to fight. He posted this video online showing the teenagers training with guns, rocket launchers, and tanks. Karen Moore teaches international relations at the University of Birmingham in the UK. He doubts Kadyrov's sons will actually go to the front lines. He says Kadyrov likes to project the idea that his forces are making a big difference on the ground, but the reality is different.
The pro-Kremlin Chechen forces often are criticized for being sort of TikTok warriors, and by that I mean people that tend to post images and footage but don't actually engage in any of the real frontline major combat operations.
There are also Chechen fighters, Moore says, who allied with Ukraine fighting against the Russians. So just how important is Ramzan Kadyrov as an ally of Russia?
I don't think that we should put as much emphasis on what he says as some commentators might want to suggest. However, we should understand that it does resonate very much within the local communities and region of the North Caucasus.
Moore says Kadyrov is trying to project solidarity with Putin's Russia at a time when people in places like Dagestan, which is next door to Chechnya, are protesting against Moscow's recruitment drive for the war in Ukraine. But Valery Zutsati says the Kadyrov-Putin alliance may not last forever.
If things don't turn out well for Russia and for Putin, then at the same time, Kadyrov is likely to be among the first, if not the first, governor of a Russian region who will try to establish, you know, his own state.
Establishing his own state, of course, would mean Ramzan Kadyrov turning against the same man who put him in power in Chechnya. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And you're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Liz Truss has been at 10 Downing Street for 1 month now. Typically, a new British prime minister would enjoy a boost in the polls at the start of their term, but there's been no honeymoon for Truss. Quite the opposite, in fact. Truss appears to be even more unpopular than her predecessor, Boris Johnson. And he was forced out of the job because of his perceived unpopularity with voters. To talk us through the British Prime Minister's rough start, we've got reporter Russell Newlove on the line from London. Russell, how did we get here?
It's been a rough 2 weeks. On Friday, the 23rd of September, Kwasi Kwarteng, the British Finance Minister, announced he was abolishing the top rate of tax. This is a rate of tax that only applies to the highest earners in the country. And it would be funded by a huge amount of borrowing. This was immediately unpopular with almost everyone. Lower taxes was never going to be a surprise. Liz Truss had always talked about being in love with a low-tax government. But what was a surprise was the depth and scale and speed of these cuts. Kwasi Kwarteng was barely 20 days into his job, and here he was announcing the biggest cut in taxes in 50 years, largely benefiting higher earners, mostly at the expense of low-income people, at a time when a cost-of-living crisis is going on.
So how did number 10 respond to all that?
Very quietly. By Monday, the only sound that could be heard was the pound in free fall. At one point, it reached its lowest value against the dollar since the dollar was invented.
Wow.
The cost of borrowing went up. This is the borrowing that was supposed to fund the tax cuts. The Bank of England intervened. And still, silence. It wasn't until Thursday when Liz Truss did a round of interviews on BBC local radio and she was taken to task.
We've also taken action to reduce our tax burden and spur.
Yeah, but Prime Minister, with respect, that
so
is the same scripted answer you've given to every BBC local radio station this morning. You've got the Bank of England stepping in now to try and clean up a mess a government has caused. That has never happened.
We have a very, very difficult economic global situation because of the war that Vladimir Putin has perpetrated in Ukraine. And countries are under pressure around
the world. Yeah, but this isn't Putin. This isn't just about Putin. I mean, your Chancellor on Friday opened up the stable door and spooked the horses so much you can almost see the economy being dragged behind them.
That's pretty brutal stuff, Russell. But I gather that Truss and the Chancellor have indeed changed their minds now. What did that policy U-turn look like?
Well, it was a long time coming. The Prime Minister and the Chancellor spent the weekend insisting they were staying the course and it was the right thing to do. It wasn't until Monday morning, in the middle of the Tory party annual conference, that the Chancellor announced he'd changed his mind. "We get it and we've listened," he tweeted. On Wednesday, Liz Truss spoke to a conference hall full of members of her own party and, addressing the U-turn and the chaos in the markets, struck a tone of, "It's not me, it's you."
As the last few weeks have shown, it will be difficult. Whenever there's change, there is disruption. And not everybody will be in favour of change, but everyone will benefit from the result.
So, Russell, what does she mean by that? What's the shift to?
Well, she said her main priorities were growth, growth and growth. That's economic growth. She talks a lot about growing the economic pie. How precisely she would spur that growth, newly divested of her major economic policy, was left to the imagination.
So looking ahead, what's Prime Minister Truss going to be focused on now?
Well, she talks about very little but growth. But by far the biggest concern amongst the public is the immediate cost of living crisis. Inflation is at its highest rate in 40 years. The price of energy is skyrocketing. Public sector workers, from dockers to postal workers, are striking. Even nurses this week are being balloted to strike. And they're all striking for better pay. And as things stand, a Liz Truss government will not lead that party to another election victory. A recent poll suggests that if an election were held tomorrow, the Tories would be crushed and they would lose hundreds of seats in Parliament.
Russell Newlove in London, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Here's a story that will make intuitive sense if you've ever taken to Twitter or Facebook to call out a company for bad service. It works. A recent experiment in China suggests that publicly posting about air pollution violations has made manufacturers clean up their act. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
China has a robust network of pollution sensors. It posts hourly emissions data online for nearly 25,000 manufacturers that produce most of the country's industrial air pollution. But the University of Hong Kong's Guo Jianghu said about a third of those companies still had emissions violations in 2019.
So the government actually has all the data, and everyone can see them. But still, a lot of enforcement was not there.
Air pollution globally leads to 7 million premature deaths each year, according to the World Health Organization. So Hua, along with other researchers in the U.S. and China, wanted to see how much social media could help. They worked with about 100 volunteers in China to call out polluting companies on Weibo, China's equivalent of Twitter. Another study author, Shada Wang, with the University of Chicago, explains.
When there's a violation, our volunteer will log on to his Weibo account.
And post something like, hey, there's a pollution violation today from this company.
Please do something about it.
Over 8 months and more than 600 Weibo messages, emissions violations in the group of manufacturers that volunteers targeted dropped by 60%.
Yeah, so it makes a big difference.
A much bigger difference than just privately sending messages to regulators, the experiment found.
You know, we're reducing their air emission by about 12%. So that's a significant reduction in actual emission levels.
In cities where volunteers targeted lots of polluters, Wang said the effects could be detected citywide.
I think that that is probably indicative that the squeaky wheel does in fact get the grease.
Glory Dolphin-Hammes leads the North America arm of IQ Air, which runs a real-time global air quality map online. She says this study backs up the idea underpinning that map.
When you give the citizens information, then you give them knowledge. And this allows them to take action. And in many cases, it allows them to take the necessary action to affect change.
The Chinese researchers used air pollution data from manufacturing sites. In California, citizens have been getting more neighborhood air quality data because of a recent statewide pollution program. Fern Unatawa-Rangoon with the Environmental Defense Fund said that's helped communities advocate for cleaner air exactly where they breathe it.
So having that data where they can hold up hard evidence to regulators or to industrial facilities, I think that has been really helpful. I think it's increasing transparency and has been an added mechanism for accountability.
The authors of the Weibo study say its findings aren't China-specific. Here's He again.
If we look at a lot of developing countries who also have high levels of pollution, it's not the case that the government didn't have regulations or standards being there, right? They are on books.
The problem, he says, is enforcement.
What we're doing here is basically trying to say citizen participation or citizen engagement, whatever you want to name it, are going to be very important to push the governments to take actions.
In China, at least, which has made cleaning up its air pollution a major goal, that seems to be true. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And you're listening to The World. When World War II ended in 1945, some Japanese soldiers never got the message. They continued to defend a remote island in the Philippines for decades afterward. A new film explores their reality and their place in history.
Lost in history, I chose to tell the story of men who are on the wrong side.
The film and their story, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. President Biden is offering pardons to thousands of people convicted of marijuana possession under federal law.
As I said when I ran for president, no one should be in jail just for using or possessing marijuana.
Yesterday, he called on senior officials to review how the drug is categorized under federal law. He encouraged state officials to decriminalize marijuana possession as well. In some ways, the U.S. is unique in its approach to policies on cannabis. To discuss this, I'm joined by Rosalie Licardo-Pakula, who is a drug policy expert at the University of Southern California. Rosalie, what countries have the most liberal policies when it comes to cannabis?
Well, I would say it depends on what you mean by liberal. If you're talking about reducing the criminal justice costs associated with possession and use, I would say Spain, Portugal, Italy, countries that have completely removed the criminal status of these drugs are probably the most liberal. They are liberal in how they treat the consumer, they are not necessarily legalization systems. The statement from President Biden was really about users, not about suppliers. And so those are countries that are most similar to what Biden is trying to do with his statement.
Now, how is the U.S. similar or different than these other countries?
I think the biggest way that the U.S. is different is that we have this federal system where the states in the U.S. have adopted more and more liberalized policies, but the federal position remains quite prohibitionist. It remains a Schedule I substance in the U.S., and Biden's recommendation will hopefully provide us the opportunity to reconsider that. In many other countries, the liberalization is happening at the national or federal level. And so the rules are being implemented with federal guidance and management rather than the federal government being silent on these issues.
Is there a global trend towards decriminalization?
Yeah, I would say that there's a movement to reduce the penalties associated with possession and use of cannabis, particularly for medical purposes. But more broadly, more countries are considering it for just simple use, in part because the human toll and the large discriminatory practices associated with these criminalization policies are becoming more and more an issue, and the public is becoming generally more aware that this is a problem.
So do any countries around the world stand out in terms of changes they've made?
What's perhaps more important than specific countries that have changed have been the discussions in countries like Germany and France to liberalize their policies. These are countries that had historically been quite restrictive, particularly around cannabis and other substances. And now there are proposals for legalization in Germany, and France is moving forward with a quite remarkable medical policy. So yes, there are some interesting examples that I think are strong bellwethers of changes to come.
And of course, cannabis remains strictly illegal in many countries. WNBA player Brittany Griner is still detained in Russia. And just yesterday, her wife, Sherelle Griner, spoke to CBS.
On its face, it just seems like my wife is a hostage. To know that our government and the foreign government is sitting down and negotiating for her release, she's a hostage.
Rosalie, do you think we can expect more instances of people being detained for buying cannabis legally in one country and then accidentally bringing it over the border into a country where it's illegal?
Unfortunately, I think that it is possible to see a growing number of cases of this as more countries liberalize and other countries buckle down in their prohibitions. It's going to become increasingly a problem, I suspect.
Are President Biden's executive orders meaningful globally? I mean, does the rest of the world look at what the U.S. does on this subject?
In the past, they have, in part because the United States has been the major advocate for the criminalization of all drugs and for the regulation of drugs globally. And we've been a major proponent of the high scheduling of most of these substances in the international treaties. But in the case of cannabis, the U.S. has been pretty much behind. You already have the U.N. recognizing the therapeutic value and changing the treatment of cannabis on the international treaty, which the U.S. voted for, but it was not the leader. You don't see the U.S. federal government leading on this.
Rosalie Licardo-Pacula is a drug policy expert at the University of Southern California and the president of the International Society for the Study of Drug Policy. Thanks a lot, Rosalie.
Thank you so much.
When street violence erupted in the English city of Leicester a few weeks ago, it took a lot of people by surprise. The city has a reputation for being a bastion of multicultural harmony, but the tensions between young Hindus and Muslims that's been simmering for months has people now asking, what's behind it all? Andrew Connolly traveled there to find out.
Good morning, everybody. The next stop will be Leicester.
Just over an hour's train ride north of London, Leicester was a key city for clothes and shoe manufacturing during the British Empire. Now it's known as one of the most ethnically diverse populations in the UK, with a sizable South Asian community. On Belgrave Road in the east of the city, Hindu temples and Islamic schools sit within a few blocks of each other. Diwali decorations are festooned across lampposts and shoppers mill around storefronts displaying Indian saris. It's a relaxed scene compared to the violent clashes that played out here recently.
We're on Nelson Road right now. Stand up.
On the evening of September 17th, hundreds of young men threw glass bottles as police struggled to keep order. Earlier that day, groups of Hindus marched through a Muslim district chanting offensive slogans. Some Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple and desecrated a flag. Since then, almost 50 arrests have been made, including some on weapons and assault charges.
I don't live that far away from where it was happening. And when it's happening on your doorstep and you're seeing hooded figures essentially marching down and fighting other people, it's quite scary.
Neil Laffia is a final year politics and economics student at the University of Leicester. We speak at a cafe in the centre of town. Laffia, who's a Hindu, is keen to stress that the rioters were a tiny unrepresentative minority.
I've spoken to some of my friends that are Muslims, and it's no way a battle for religion. I think it's been branded as Hindus vs Muslims, where I don't think it's necessarily true. And it upsets me because it's sort of profiling all of us into one kind of group.
As the riots played out in Leicester, the BBC analysed 200,000 posts on Twitter related to the mayhem, and it found that over half was sent from accounts in India. Laffia says that he's not surprised.
I think Indian politics, especially the right-wing extremist Indian politics, is playing a massive part. I think they've seen the flames and they're just adding fuel to the fire. I don't think it should be happening, and it's very dangerous that it's happening.
In Leicestershire, where there was violence that broke out, now the High Commission of India has spoken out condemning the violence.
This is an Indian news channel reporting a statement by the Indian High Commission in London. It condemned the attacks on Hindu religious sites in Leicester, conspicuously failing to mention any other faith group. Shokat Adam Patel is a long-time resident of Leicester and thinks that the recent street violence was inevitable.
Yeah, so I was saddened, heartbroken almost, but not shocked, unfortunately. As somebody who's involved in community activity, we have been seeing for the last decade a change in how people were behaving with each other. We were becoming a lot more ghettoised, people living in different communities.
Patel, who volunteers for a charity that fights Islamophobia, says that city officials, police and community leaders have long taken for granted Leicester's reputation as a model for integration, and that they've overlooked the building tension.
This is really important, that if the Muslim community didn't just go out and start beating Hindu individuals up. This was in response to what they felt was provocation for a sustained period of time. Now, saying that, there's absolutely no condoning of any form of violence.
This idea of Leicester being the most harmonious multicultural city in Britain is very much a convenient one, really, for the city's leadership.
Experts agree that divisions here have been expanding for some time, fueled in part by declining economic standards.
My name's Chris Ammon. I'm Associate Professor in the School of Criminology at the University of Leicester.
The pandemic, the energy crunch and a looming recession, it's all put pressure on the social fabric of Leicester. But Alan insists that the influence of India's Hindu nationalist politics cannot be dismissed.
I think the fact that they were chanting the same slogans that as the Hindu movement has chanted when perpetrating violent anti-Muslim attacks in India, I think that was seen as a kind of like a signal that actually, yes, there was some involvement in there. There was some inspiration. As to what the precise role is and as to the extent to which that was there in Leicester, I think it's very difficult to tell at this moment in time.
Outside Leicester's town hall, I meet Rita Patel, a local politician with the Labour Party. She points to the shrinking public space for young people as a problem, and funding cuts for community groups.
Camping trips, to being able to do car mechanics or just activities, a place to hang out, listen to music, do joint activities together.
Patel thinks that malign external influence can only thrive if there is fertile ground.
When we take away those kind of opportunities, what then happens is communities get fragmented, people lose touch with people, people then are more prey to and vulnerable to assumptions and social media and misinformation, fake news, and that's exactly, I think, what's been happening.
Leicester's mayor has launched an independent inquiry into the recent disturbances. It'll look into possible connections with Hindu and Islamist extremist groups from the outside. But as dust settles in this truly global city, the local community is also looking within for answers. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in Leicester, England.
It's that time of the week when we test you on your knowledge of the top global news stories. We've covered the environment, health issues, and global scandals this week. Take the quiz on our Instagram page and tell us how you did. You can find it at theworld.org-instagram. On Easter Island yesterday, a forest fire damaged some of the island's iconic giant head statues. The damage is being described as irreparable. Easter Island is a special territory of Chile and lies in the Pacific, about 2,000 miles off of Chile's coast. It's believed the statues, known as moai, were carved in the 13th century by the island's original inhabitants. For more on what happened and the significance of the stone statues, we reached out to Terry Hunt. He's an expert on Easter Island and a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. Terry, what do you know about what happened on Easter Island yesterday?
I don't know a lot of the details yet, but I did receive some photos from friends on the island. So I saw the extent and location of the fire at the statue quarry where about 400 of the statues or moai were being produced in ancient times.
Do we know anything about how the fire started and how many of the statues that were damaged?
I don't have details about that yet, but these brush fires are fairly common on the island. However, what I would say is that fire is very dangerous to these statues given the aggregate nature of the tuff, the volcanic tuff. It has pore space in it and included rocks, and the heat can create fracturing. So there could be extensive damage.
Tell us the origin of these statues.
So these statues are part of a Polynesian tradition of making images that are your deified ancestors. And they are common in Polynesia, but in Easter Island, they became very important. They became large and specialized in style. And there are about 1,000 on the island.
And how important are these statues for the inhabitants there?
The moai are really important to the native people on the island today. They represent a past that they are very proud of, and they represent really their roots, their history, their glorious past on this tiny island.
What are the moai made out of?
Most of them are made from a source at Rano Raraku. It is a volcanic cinder cone, and the statues are made out of a welded tuff from that eruption. It's a relatively soft material with a volcanic bomb inclusion so that denser rocks can fall down into the ash. All of that material was welded together. And so it's not a homogeneous material, but it is, compared to solid rock, it's softer. And the statues were carved out of that and then transported from that quarry to just about every part of the island. But it is a form of volcanic ejecta or ash that comes from a pyroclastic eruption.
Are there still volcanic eruptions on Easter Island?
No, there are not. It is a volcanic island, of course. And I think geologists would talk about the island being dormant because in geologic time, things could happen in the future, but there haven't been any eruptions for several thousand years.
What protections are in place around these statues to keep them from being damaged? I mean, did something go wrong, or is this just kind of, this stuff happens sometimes?
Well, Mauhenua, the native corporation that manages the island and the island's archaeology, has many things in place to protect the moai from, say, the impacts of tourism or things like bulldozing or making a road, etc. A fire can happen by accident, and then there may not be anything you can do except try to put it out. So they are actively managing and protecting this heritage.
But in general, you can't just kind of wander up and touch the statues, can you? I mean, are they kind of roped off, or can you?
They are protected, and it is against the rules to go and touch or sit or stand on a moai, of course. And the areas that tourists visit are roped off or have designated where visitors can see things but not have an impact on things.
Do you think the statues can be restored in any meaningful way?
Sometimes repair with concrete, etc., might work, but that really destroys the integrity of the statue as a historical object, as a cultural object. So I'm hoping for the best and fearing the worst, and we'll see what we learn.
Terry Hunt is an expert on Easter Island and a professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Thank you.
Now, a news update from the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince. It's something we asked about yesterday on the show. With all the gang violence and general dysfunction in the country, will Haiti consider some kind of international intervention? In her reporting, the world's Tubisai Seya spoke with a mother in Port-au-Prince who described what gang violence has led to.
Hospital or closing. At the moment, there is no school, so the kids are basically on house arrest. They don't go anywhere. I keep them at home.
Well, this week, Haiti's prime minister made the case for international assistance. Ariel Henry began his address to Haitians by saying the situation is serious. He then turned to the international community. Henri said doctors and nurses should be able to take the road to the hospital. Right now, they're blocked by gangs. He also said children should be able to go to school without being afraid. These are some of the things international assistance could help guarantee that local police can't. So far, the United Nations has proposed one form of assistance, a humanitarian corridor that would help get aid and gasoline to people in need. Now the question is, what countries will help? There's a new film out called Onoda, 10,000 Nights in the Jungle. It tells a wild story that seems improbable, but it's true. It's about a group of Japanese soldiers who occupied an island in the Philippines during World War II. But because of their secret mission, they didn't know the war ended in August 1945. And cut off from Japan and the rest of the world, they continued to defend this island up into the 1970s. When Americans landed on the moon, these Japanese soldiers found out about it in their jungle outpost on a transistor radio. That's a scene there from a new French-Japanese feature film called Onoda. My colleague Marco Werman recently had a chance to talk about the story with the filmmaker.
Director Arthur Harari joins me. It is great to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
So, Arthur, your movie focuses on this group of Japanese soldiers defending this Philippines island of Lubang. But the title refers to the man who survives and ultimately leaves the island, Hiro Onoda. I'm not giving anything away with that, but I won't say any more. What drew you to his story?
I had the will to make an adventure film. I was reading a lot of stuff. I had told my father that I was looking for a subject, and I had borrowed some books in his book place in his home, and I was reading, I don't know, tales from sailors or stuff like that, and I wasn't able to find anything convincing. And then one evening he told me about the story of Onoda, but very almost as a joke. He said, well, if you don't find anything convincing, you can always make a film about that Japanese soldier who stayed for years in an island fighting the war alone. And I didn't know about the stories. I found a book about Onoda, and it was so fascinating. And I felt like a very strong connection and like an appeal. It felt almost miraculous that no film had ever been made on the subject. I understood that it was more than just an adventure, that the undercurrents of this story were very strong and powerful for me, and I felt that I had to be the one making this film.
What starts as an adventure film in your mind kind of turns into a whole kind of reflection on war. In this age of connectivity, it may be hard for us to grasp how it is possible, even on a remote island, not to have received a piece of news like the war is over, or if you did hear it, not to believe it. But as we learn, these soldiers were given strict marching orders for their mission on this island. That is the major in charge of these soldiers' special training. It's a secret mission they're on, and after telling them they'll never be known for their struggle, he says, "You are forbidden from killing yourself. It may take 3 or 5 years, but whatever happens, we will be back for you. You may have to live on coconuts, eat roots, eat dirt, whatever happens, survive." As your film unfolds, Arthur, it's clear that each of these men suffers from some sort of psychological trauma as they await their stand-down orders. As you learned about what these soldiers lived through, how did you start to understand where the trauma began? Was it before agreeing to this mission? Was it during and after training? Was it while they were on the island?
I'm not very sure until now to know what was the problem with each of these men and mostly with Onoda. I could not pretend that I have resolved or solved the mystery. Onoda is still a kind of mystery to me. And this is why I really decided to see it as a fiction. To me, the film is not, of course, it's based on this true story, but even from the very start, I saw it as a kind of great allegory or a great legend. The story was so crazy that it's a fiction in itself.
And even though you develop this as a fiction, the broad contours of Onoda's story are real. Were you able to actually visit Lubang Island, and what kind of sense did it give you of the confinement these men faced over the years?
I did not go to Lubang. I must say it was, of course, my first project was to go and even shoot the film on Lubang. But it turned out it was very, very difficult and very expensive to shoot on such a remote island, because it's a very, very small and remote island in the Philippines. And so, well, making the film and even imagining how to find money to make the film was a very, very difficult challenge from France. And I must say that when I decided to make this film, I hadn't made my first feature film. So I was completely out of the reality of how I could do the film. So when we found out a way of financing the film, actually we decided at some point to try making the film in Cambodia.
I mean, it is what these soldiers are told to do: adapt, improvise, just don't die. And in the attempt to survive, we see some pretty despicable behavior among these men. It is war, after all, and for them it continues after it's over. They also display surprising tenderness at times. I'm just wondering, Arthur, what do you want the audience to take away from your depiction of Onoda and his fellow soldiers?
Well, complexity. When I am an audience, part of an audience, or when I read a book or whatever, it's I'm interested in complexity and in moral ambivalence. And I think that war and violent episodes of history are, of course, the occasion of understanding human complexity. So the fact that we can try to be standing next to someone who, in the actions that he has to make, that he thinks he's compelled to make, is both a murderer and also a friend to someone who became like his brother. This seems interesting as an experience to understand the limits of humankind, the deep complexity of how man can be struggling with history and lost in history, and also a very bad element of history. The fact is that I chose to tell the story of men who are on the wrong side.
Arthur Harari is the director of the new feature film Onoda, 10,000 Nights in the Jungle. Arthur, great to meet you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you.
Onoda opens in New York today before hitting screens across the country, as well as streaming platforms. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.